On this Thursday, June 25th, we welcome you to Washington Today here on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. Speaker Nancy Pelosi tamping down any possibility that House Democrats would pursue impeachment of Attorney General William Barr over accusations that he has politicized the Justice Department. Some Democrats have expressed interest in pursuing impeachment proceedings, but the Speaker says the referendum on the Attorney General should be done at the ballot box in November. The New York Times reporting that Joe Biden is now ahead in all key battleground states with just over 4 months to go in campaign 2020. It comes as former Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina says she will be voting for Biden this year. Coronavirus continues to play havoc with the U.S. economy as the Labor Department reports that 1.48 million Americans filing for unemployment benefits last week. And Texas is now putting a pause on any plans to reopen that state's economy. The story shaping Washington Today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin on Capitol Hill, where the House Democrats spending the day debating and voting on their police reform bill. It follows 1 month after the brutal death of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of a white police officer. His death, of course, sparking a nationwide call to address police misconduct and racial injustice. The legislation, by the way, is titled the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act of 2020. It has provisions making it easier to remove officers while also prohibiting racial profiling by law enforcement officials. It would ban the no-knock warrants in federal drug cases. It would also classify chokeholds as a civil rights violation and establish a national registry of police misconduct maintained by the Justice Department. Congressman Jerry Nadler is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee.
Across the nation and around the world, the streets are lined with protesters demanding fundamental change in the culture of law enforcement and meaningful accountability for officers who commit misconduct. Today, we answer their call. We value and respect the many brave and honorable police officers who put their lives on the line every day to protect us in our communities. We know that most law enforcement officers do their jobs with dignity, selflessness, and honor, and they are deserving of our respect and gratitude for all they do to keep us safe. But we must also acknowledge that there are too many exceptions. Too many law enforcement officers do not uphold the ethic of protecting and serving their community. Instead, the reality for too many Americans, especially for too many African Americans, is that police officers are perceived as a threat to their liberties, to their dignity, and all too often, to their safety. And to those who do not believe it, look at these tragic statistics. African Americans are more than twice as likely to be shot and killed by police each year. And black men between the ages of 15 and 34 are approximately 10 times more likely to be killed by police than other Americans. This is not a new problem. Our country's history of racism and racially motivated violence, rooted in the original sin of slavery and lynchings and Jim Crow, and systemic racism continues to haunt our nation. We see it in the rates of COVID deaths, in our system of mass incarceration, and in the vast chasm of economic inequality, all of which fall disproportionately on the backs of African Americans. And we see it in the harassment and excessive force that people of color routinely face by far too many of our police officers. An unmistakable message has been sent to African Americans in this country, that they are second-class citizens, and that their lives are somehow of less value. Well, let me state clearly and unequivocally that black lives matter. George Floyd mattered. Breonna Taylor mattered. Eric Garner mattered. Amadou Diallo mattered. Tamir Rice mattered. Walter Scott mattered. Laquan McDonald and so many others mattered. Rayshard Brooks mattered. And the countless other people who have lost their lives at the hands of law enforcement mattered. For far too long, pleas for justice and reform have fallen on deaf ears in Congress. But that changes today. The George Floyd Justice and Policing Act would finally allow for meaningful accountability in cases of police misconduct, and it would begin the process of reimagining policing in the 21st century.
That from the House floor earlier today with Jerry Nadler, Democrat of New York, chair of the House Judiciary Committee. This bill, though, has little chance of becoming law, despite calls from both parties for quick action to address police misconduct. Efforts to find common ground have largely devolved into partisan finger-pointing. We'll get some more details on that with Amber Phillips of The Washington Post. More from the House floor today with Ohio's Republican Congressman Jim Jordan.
What happened to George Floyd last month in Minneapolis was tragic. Horrific, and as wrong could be. His family deserves justice, and I hope they get that swiftly. Bad police officers must be held accountable for their misconduct, and justice must be carried out. While we focus on rooting out the bad apples, we need to remember that the overwhelming majority of law enforcement officers are good people who put themselves in harm's way to keep the rest of us safe. We need meaningful legislation that increases training, ensures transparency, holds everyone accountable, and guarantees that tragedies similar to what happened in Minneapolis don't happen again. This moment in our great nation's history demands that we work together across the aisle to fashion legislation that works, legislation that actually makes a real and lasting difference. Unfortunately, Democrats haven't done that, and they show no sign of wanting to do that. They didn't consult us when they put together this legislation. In committee, just last week, we Republicans offered 12 thoughtful, good amendments. Every single one voted down. Every single one. And in the Senate, just yesterday, Democrats voted to not even debate the common sense proposal put forward by Senator Scott. Now, it was interesting. There was some bipartisan support for moving to debate. Two Democrats, one independent, voted with the Republicans, but yet Democrats chose partisanship over real reform. We need reform, but House Democrats have delivered a bill that is designed to keep cops in the car. And when you do that, it makes our communities less safe by preventing good law enforcement officers from being able to do their job. That's what this bill is going to do. Now is not the time to cripple the men and women who so selflessly serve our communities. This bill has serious due process concerns for law enforcement officers. Bad officers must be held accountable for their crimes. No one disputes that. But this bill would punish unadjudicated allegations against officers, including officers who may be innocent of those allegations. This bill will make our law enforcement officers less safe by prohibiting them from obtaining surplus equipment from our federal government. We had an amendment in the committee. It says, what about just allowing folks on the border, dealing with the cartels, dealing with the terrorists they deal with down there? What about letting those law enforcement agencies have access to surplus military equipment? Democrats said no. That was one of the 12 amendments they said no to. This equipment allows officers to protect themselves and the communities they serve. For example, armored vehicles in Texas were used to rescue people from rising floodwaters during Hurricane Harvey. Helmets saved the lives of officers who were shot at while responding to the terrorist attack at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando in 2016. And this bill does nothing. This bill does nothing to address the calls for defunding and dismantling police departments. Frankly, I have never heard such a crazy idea. This concept, most insane public policy proposal I have ever heard, and I've been in politics a few years. This will make our communities less safe.
That from House GOP Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio. Now, prior to the start of today's session, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi gathering members of the Congressional Black Caucus. She spoke on the steps of the U.S. Capitol.
Today, we are standing here for justice as we bring forward the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. Exactly 1 month ago, George Floyd spoke his final words, "I can't breathe," and changed the course of history. Since that horrific day, Americans from every walk of life and corner of the country have been marching, protesting, and demanding that this moment of national agony become one of national action. Today, with the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, the House is honoring his life and the lives of all killed by police brutality and pledging never again. The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act will fundamentally transform the culture of policing to address systemic racism, curb police brutality, and bring accountability to our police departments. It will save lives. As the distinguished chair, a woman of the Black Caucus, author of this resolution, has spelled out. 2 weeks ago, Philonis Floyd, the brother of George Floyd, testified powerfully before the Judiciary Committee. He said then, the people marching in the streets are telling us enough is enough. Be the leaders that this country, this world needs. He went on to say, George's name means something. If his death ends up changing the world for the better, and I think it will, he said, I think it has, then he died as he had lived. It is on you to make sure his death isn't in vain. Today, we have the opportunity and the obligation to ensure that his death and the deaths of so many others are not in vain.
From Capitol Hill earlier today, already Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell indicating that he will not take up the House Democratic bill, and Republican Leader Kevin McCarthy blaming the Speaker for politics behind this issue.
Contrast to how Speaker Pelosi responded to Senator Tim Scott's bill. She said Republicans are trying to get away with murder, the murder of George Floyd. Tim Scott has not been working on this bill just for 1 month. This has been a life passion of Tim, with his own personal life experience. That's why he found his success when opportunity zones or funding of black colleges. Her words are reprehensible. This is actually a new low for Speaker Pelosi when it comes to just trying to score points with her newly radical base. Think for one moment. This is the Speaker of the House of Representatives. The job of Speaker is too big for words so small. Does anyone in her conference stand by her on these words? Do they call Tim Scott wanting to get away with murder?
Today's news conference with the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy. It's available on our website at cspan.org. And joining us on the phone here in Washington is congressional reporter Amber Phillips of The Washington Post. There really seems to be gridlock between the Democrats and Republicans, what we saw today and what we saw yesterday in the Senate when it comes to police reform. So bottom line, where do things stand tonight?
Things stand at a stalemate right now. I think, the frustrating thing among those who want to see police reform and public opinion and nationwide protests to show that a majority of Americans are in that category is that both sides in Congress agree something needs to be done. But we're really, Steve, seeing a familiar scenario playing out where Democrats and Republicans can't agree on the fundamentals. They have started blaming each other for not compromising. The White House has not played a role in trying to bring both sides together. In fact, Trump issued a veto threat on this House Democratic bill. And all that makes it more difficult to actually get something done, to rise from the ashes of this Senate Republican bill that got blocked than this House Democratic bill that has, no substantial Republican support.
Walk us through the thinking of the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell trying to get this vote before the July 4th recess rather than sit down with Democrats and hammer out a bipartisan compromise.
Yeah, it's a good question. Democrat critics have said it raises questions about his motives. Patty Murray of Washington said, "We've all been here a while. We know that bills drafted in partisan silos and brought to the floor don't pass." That being said, Republicans push back and say, hey, Democrats, you guys put together your own bill in the Senate and in the House as well. There was only a bipartisan meeting a day before that Senate vote. But in terms of the timing of McConnell needing to have some kind of vote or an attempt to have a vote, he does not want his members to go home over the 4th of July holiday empty-handed. The Washington Post poll shows that a majority of Republicans are sympathetic to protesters out on the street. This has spurred Republican action in an election year on an issue they don't normally prioritize. And that's not something Republicans or any lawmaker, just say, tends to do. They don't want to be in unfamiliar territory so close to the election year. But public opinion, including on the Republican side, demanded that they at least try. I don't know that it demands they try even more to get in agreement with Democrats.
We're talking with Amber Phillips of The Washington Post. How much authority does Washington have with police forces? Because obviously they are run primarily by local governments, by cities and towns.
Yeah, that's right. And so you saw President Trump come out with an executive order that tried to use leverage. And I think the Senate Republican bill did the same. Say, okay, we're not going to give you guys federal grants if you don't comply with certain things. The big difference between what Democrats want and what Republicans want is Republicans, when they say comply, they would like police, county and state police forces to submit data every time there's a chokehold use, every time there's a no-knock warrant use. Tim Scott, leading this effort on the Senate side, said that's going to allow them to better understand where this force is used and perhaps down the line take action. Democrats argue they want to leverage federal money to say you can't use, you know, chokeholds or some no-knock warrants. And in some cases, they want to make that federal law to say it's just against the law to be able to do that.
So as you look at the calendar with the party conventions in August, a third of the Senate up for election in November, all 435 House seats, realistically, will anything get done?
It's hard to see that happening because let's say there is potential for a compromise. And I do see areas that overlap, right? Like both sides want to establish a national database to track police misconduct. There are Republicans who are open to making it easier for people to sue officers for misconduct. But even if they're going to get a compromise, they're not in session very much in July. They're off in August and for most of August, unless something changes. And then you come back and everyone's focused on the general election and their own general elections. And the majority of the Senate could be at stake. I think it makes it much harder for senators, particularly Republicans, to take anything that could be a political risk for them.
So where does that put the Democrats and Republicans as they face voters in November?
Well, Democrats tend to feel like they're on the right side of public opinion on this. I guess we'll see. But polls show that there is the potential for voters to go vote based on whether they think their lawmaker or the president is helping address racial injustice. So Democrats point out that they have, for example, numerous civil rights groups, other parents and people have been killed by police supporting their proposals in their legislation. Black Americans, who are obviously a big part of this conversation, also support Joe Biden by historically large numbers, according to a new poll the Washington Post has out. So Democrats feel like things are on their side. I think as far as Republicans, perhaps the calculation there politically might be that this isn't a top priority for people come November. We still have the economy, the coronavirus. They can champion conservative judges, the Supreme Court, tax reform. They could try to steer the conversation elsewhere if it turns out we're in the fall and Congress hasn't done anything.
Amber Phillips, her work available at WashingtonPost.com. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
With police reform, protests, and the coronavirus continuing to affect the country, watch our live, unfiltered coverage of the government's response with briefings from the White House, Congress, governors and mayors from across the country updating the situations, and from the Campaign 2020 trail. Join the conversation every day on our live call-in program, Washington Journal. And if you missed any of our live coverage, watch anytime on demand at cspan.org. Or listen on the go with the free C-SPAN radio app.
For this Thursday, June 25th, we welcome you back to Washington Today here on C-SPAN Radio. Here are some of your other headlines. A Seattle arena has a new name, home to the city's incoming NHL franchise and the WNBA's Storm team. Amazon has purchased the naming rights, and it will be known as, quote, the Climate Pledge Arena, rather than using the company's name. CEO Jeff Bezos breaking the news earlier today on his Instagram account. And the Trump family losing an attempt to gag the president's niece Mary Trump from writing a tell-all book about them. In a statement, Simon & Schuster praising today's decision and said it looks forward to publishing the book titled Too Much and Never Enough. On Capitol Hill tomorrow, the House is expected to pass historic Washington, D.C. statehood legislation, marking a step towards representation for D.C.'s 700,000 residents. But momentum on the effort will likely end in the House, with the Republicans controlling the Senate and the president vowing to block such a move. During remarks on Capitol Hill, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser was asked about the management of D.C.'s budget and what would happen if the district became the 51st state.
Well, sure. Let me first address your earlier question about the district's finances. And I'm not an expert on Georgia's finances, but I do know mine pretty well. And our city has balanced 24 budgets. We have reserve funds that have allowed us to balance this budget that's in front of the council right now. We have a AAA bond rating. And unlike the representative's district or any city in Georgia, we function as a city, a county, and a state. We are attracting residents and businesses, and we're very proud of the progress of our schools, public safety, and city services. So I frequently tell people I wouldn't trade places with any mayor or governor in the United States of America. And I feel very good about our position to come back from the current recession, as Mr. Mendelson has already stated. What is clear to me from the attention that Americans have paid to the district is something that we know already, that they don't really know, in a lot of cases, that we're different than they are. They assume they're United States citizens. They know we have a congresswoman, so they don't even think about the fact that we don't have voting senators or a congresswoman doesn't have the vote. And it certainly never occurred to them that the president could move the army to address a local policing matter. And so that has been, I know Congresswoman Norton and all of us have been very focused on talking about that and making sure that the residents of the United States recognize that the only way to address that is through statehood. It's also been very important for us to explain that you're still going to have a nation's capital when we become the 51st state. There will be a federal enclave that the Congress will continue to exercise jurisdiction over. It will encompass all of the major federal buildings and functions of the federal government, the National Mall, the museums, and memorials. But it won't have 700,000 people in it that don't have a vote. And so that is what has been my pleasure to talk to the people of America about.
Those comments earlier today on Capitol Hill from D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. By the way, the last time the House voted on D.C. statehood was 1993. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow gaining nearly 300 points today. The Nasdaq rose 107. The S&P closing 33 points higher. One-time political lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who pled guilty back in 2006 to felony corruption charges, facing a new set of legal troubles tonight. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that Abramoff has been charged with fraud and sued by the SEC in connection with the sale of a cryptocurrency. An executive who ran the company behind that offering has also been indicted for wire fraud and money laundering. On to coronavirus, Texas Governor Greg Abbott is temporarily pausing the state's reopening as both the state and the nation seeing a record-breaking surge in COVID-19 cases. Yesterday alone, the U.S. recorded more than 45,000 cases and more than 5,000 from the Lone Star State. Houston and Harris County, Texas is rapidly running out of ICU beds. And at the Texas Medical Center, the city's largest hospital complex, the ICU there is at 100% capacity. Alabama, Mississippi, and Missouri also breaking their single-day records. And Disneyland has postponed its mid-July reopening because of a surge of cases in California. During a conference call with reporters, CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield says the number of COVID-19 cases in the U.S. may be 10 times higher than reported.
Dr. Redfield, I was very intrigued by something you said, that for every case that's tested positive, there might be 10 that weren't detected. Can you expand on that? And I think you probably know the Wall Street Journal has said that the CDC estimates many millions more cases than have been diagnosed. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I mean, we have one of the realities, because this virus causes so much asymptomatic infection. You know, and again, we don't know the exact number. There's ranges between 20% as high as 80% in different groups. But clearly it causes significant asymptomatic infection. That the traditional approach of looking for symptomatic illness and diagnosing it obviously underestimated the total amount of infections. And so now with the availability of serology, the ability to test for antibody, CDC has established surveillance throughout the United States using a variety of different mechanisms for serology. And that information now is coming in, and it will continue as we look at the range, for example, where you have a different range of percent infections, say, in the West Coast, where it may be limited, say, 1% or so, and then you have the Northeast, where it may be much more common. The estimates that we have right now that I mentioned, and again, this will continue with more and more surveillance, is that it's about 10 times more people have antibody in these jurisdictions that had documented infection. So that gives you an idea. You know, what the ultimate number is going to be, is it 5 to 1, is it 10 to 1, is it 12 to 1? But I think a good rough estimate right now is 10 to 1. And I just wanted to highlight that because at the beginning, we were seeing the diagnosing cases of individuals that presented in hospitals and emergency rooms. They were in nursing homes. And we were selecting for symptomatic or higher-risk groups. There wasn't a lot of testing that was done of younger asymptomatic individuals. So I think it's important for us to realize that we probably recognized about 10% of the outbreak by the methods that were used to diagnose it between March, April, and May. And I think we are continuing to try to enhance surveillance systems for individuals that are asymptomatic to be able to start detecting that asymptomatic infection more in real time.
Dr. Redfield is the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And during today's teleconference call, this question on how states need to respond because of the spike in coronavirus cases.
I'm speaking to you from Florida, where we've had another day of 5,000-plus new positive cases. Number has we've seen similar numbers in other southern states. Now the northeastern states are imposing a mandatory quarantine for anyone who travels from here to there. It's something that Florida did to the northeastern states a couple of months ago. Are these quarantines really going to be effective? Is there that much migration between the two regions that it's really going to cause a problem, or is the problem for these surges elsewhere?
You know, thank you for your question. I think the comment that I will make is that clearly we have seen, as you commented, in the southern states, some increases in cases. You know, I keep trying to remind people that the real focus is the consequence of those cases, particularly hospitalizations, mortality, and death. Obviously, the also consequences in terms of the disruption of the economy, education system, et cetera. So I don't think we have any clear evidence. As you know, right now, the individual states are making their individual decisions. I think the tone of your question, which is good, is I think we don't have any evidence-based data to support the public health value of that decision. Obviously, it's an independent decision that independent governors are going to make.
Today's teleconference with the CDC director. And during an interview on CNN, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo criticizing other governors and their response to this pandemic, saying some states who rushed to reopen their economies were playing politics. And he singled out Florida's Republican governor, Ron DeSantis.
Look, I've said the same thing for 3 months. You could just play the tape. I was listening to Sanjay on the section before. 3 months ago, I said, we're playing politics with this virus, and the virus is going to win. It was all politics. And the virus, you can't beat a virus with politics. A virus isn't Democratic or Republican. We were in political denial, and people were saying, don't worry about it. It's only the flu. Go about your business. Open the economy. Liberate New York. We took a different track in this state, but I said it's going to catch up with us, and you're going to see that virus go up, and you're going to lose Americans you don't need to lose, and it's actually going to hurt the economy. It's not going to help the economy. You open up the economy too fast, the virus goes up, the stock market is going to go down.
Yeah.
And that's right where we are. And we can't deny it anymore. We played politics and we lost. Now follow the science. That's what it's been about from day one. And what we're seeing in New York is, look, we did the right thing. And New Yorkers paid a terrible cost, as you know, Allison.
Yeah.
They've been locked up. They've been closing their businesses. We have the virus under control, finally. We had to flatten the curve.
Yeah.
We don't want to go back.
Remember back in May when Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida had talked about how basically blocking people from hotspots at that time, New York, had been very effective for Florida. So let me play that for you to remind you.
I quarantined them in March, and everyone in New York media was blowing a gasket. How could you do this? That was the right decision. That was the number one landing pad. Had we not done the quarantine, you would have had way more cases, hospitalizations, the whole nine yards. I have no doubt that quarantine saved lives.
So, what do you say to him today, now that the tables have turned?
Oh, I say to them all, look at the numbers. You played politics with this virus and you lost. You told the people of your state and you told the people of this country, White House, don't worry about it. Just open up, go about your business. This is all Democratic hyperbole. Oh, really? Now you see 27 states with the numbers going up. You see the death projections going up. You see the economy going down. It was never politics. It was always science. And they were in denial. And denial is not a life strategy. You see, now they're saying, well, don't worry. It's not really that the virus is going up. Just the testing numbers are going up. I don't even know what that means mathematically.
That from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on CNN earlier today. Meanwhile, at a Capitol Hill news conference earlier today, there was this exchange between CNN's congressional reporter Manu Raju and the House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy, all on the president's weekend reference in Tulsa, Oklahoma, referring to coronavirus as, quote, the Kung Flu.
As the president has been describing the coronavirus, he's been calling it the Kung Flu. Do you think that's an appropriate way to characterize the coronavirus?
Do you think that's the most pressing issue you have about the coronavirus?
Think about that.
I know, but what I'm thinking about is why that is your most pressing issue as a question.
Well,
when we just seen a spike in coronavirus, you're concerned about somebody and the way they name it. That's appalling to me. You know what? I think we should all focus, learn more about this disease, and stop this virus. But every time I've come here, you've always had those type of questions. It's interesting to me if that's what your viewers care most about. Because you know what? You know what my constituents care most about? Their safety and their health. And if you want to debate what's it called and what's it not, that's not what they're debating. They want to make sure they see a vaccine for it, and that's what we're moving towards. Therapies for it, and you see great movement. We've done things this country has never done when it comes to the FDA and others. So no, that's not my biggest concern. My biggest concern is the safety of Americans, and that's what I look for.
Testing be ramped up.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate the time.
From Capitol Hill earlier today and the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy. Meanwhile, presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden attacking the president over his efforts to overturn the Affordable Care Act, calling it cruel and heartless, especially during this pandemic. His remarks in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. The speech was timed to coincide with today's deadline for the Trump administration to file its legal brief in the Supreme Court. That brief supports a lawsuit brought by Republican-led states seeking to overturn the ACA. More from today's speech.
We're going to have to find a way to keep our economy running as we bring the number of cases down. The president wants us to believe there's a choice between the economy and public health. Amazingly, he still hasn't grasped the most basic fact of this crisis. To fix the economy, we have to get control over the virus. Say it again. To fix the economy, we have to get control over the virus. He's like a child who can't believe this has happened to him. All his whining and self-pity. Well, this pandemic didn't happen to him. It happened to all of us. And his job isn't to whine about it. His job is to do something about it, to lead. If I have the honor of being president, I promise you I will lead. I will do everything I can to take responsibility and ease this burden on you and your families. I'll put your family first. That will begin with a dramatic expansion of health coverage and bold steps to lower health care costs.
Democrats are claiming that if the Affordable Care Act, often referred to as Obamacare, is repealed, an estimated 20 million Americans could be forced off their coverage. And in campaign 2020, the president's once commanding advantage among white voters has nearly vanished, a development that would all but preclude the president's reelection if it persists. Joe Biden now has a 21-point lead among white college graduates, and the president is losing among white voters in three northern battleground states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. A separate New York Times Siena College survey that we talked about earlier this week showing that Joe Biden nationally is leading the president by 14 points, 50% for Biden to 36% for President Trump. On our podcast, The Weekly, Washington executive editor Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal offering his assessment on this election with 4 months to go before Election Day. He says Michigan will be key.
Not really, no. And he's not he's a hard person to really dislike. I mean, obviously some people do, but you know, there was a kind of a intense and sometimes visceral dislike of Hillary Clinton on the part of a fairly wide swath of Americans, and that just isn't true of Joe Biden. That's not the way people look at him.
And of course, if there is a microcosm in all of this, and I love the headline from your column last month in the Wall Street Journal, referring to Michigan, you're saying the state has nearly every ingredient going into the election stew. Can you explain?
Well, so first of all, it's an important swing state, one that had been Democratic, that Donald Trump won in 2016, and the Democrats need to win back now. It has moved more Democratic since then and has a Democratic governor who is now under consideration to be Joe Biden's running mate. And unfortunately, it has been hit very hard by the coronavirus, so it has all the pains, you know, health-wise and economic, that any state has in very high measure. So you take all the combustible elements of 2020 and you roll them all together and you find them all in Michigan, which is why I think it's a really fascinating battleground. And it usually is a battleground state, but I think it's also a kind of an exemplar this year of all the forces that are at work.
More of our conversation with Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal on our podcast, The Weekly. You can also listen to the full interview tomorrow afternoon here on C-SPAN Radio at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And a reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's also available as a podcast. You can check it out on our website at cspan.org. For this Thursday, June 25th, I'm Steve Scully in Washington. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your evening.